All right, so let's go through this and see what we've learned. Let's go through a series of quotes from Jenny McCarthy. Quote, what does it take for people to start listening? We vaccinated our babies and something happened. Now, as you know, the notion that vaccines cause autism was first born of a British gastroenterologist named Andrew Wakefield, who proposed that the combination measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, or MMR, caused the disorder. It was reported actually as a series of 8 patients contained within this paper published in 1998 in Lancet. Now, since that was that hypothesis was first raised, and I think this is what Jenny McCarthy is referring to when she says that's the autism shot, isn't it? There have been 10 studies that have been performed, 10 epidemiological studies, which is the way that you answer this question. Here's 5, and here's the other 5. Really, millions of children who either received or didn't receive the MMR vaccine were examined to determine whether there was an increased risk of autism in the vaccinated group. And the results were clear and consistent and reproducible, no. And what one thing Chris Sheedy said that's absolutely true is that doesn't prove that MMR vaccine doesn't cause autism, because there really are no proofs in science, certainly not in epidemiological studies. You know, what happens as you do more and more studies is you make the things all the more statistically unlikely. I mean, you know, when I was little, when I was 5, I believed that I could fly. I used to watch Superman on TV. I mean, you know, I know this is with the George Reeve before the Christopher Reeve Superman, but, you know, he would put his arms in front of him with the interlocking thumb grip, and he would do this, and I did that, and I put the towel on my back as a cape and tried to fly, and I'm not going to surprise you by telling you unsuccessfully, okay? I never successfully flew. And I tried a handful of times, but if I tried a billion times, that wouldn't have proven that I couldn't fly. It would have only made it statistically less likely. I think we now have 10 epidemiological studies that have all shown the same thing, and I think we can say now that a truth has emerged, although there are no definitive proofs, a truth has emerged. Similarly, there were a couple years after Andrew Wakefield raised the notion that MMR caused autism was the notion that thimerosal, the ethyl mercury-containing preservative in vaccines, caused autism. This was something that Jenny McCarthy also raised on this show. And when it was raised, when it became part of the public's consciousness, the CDC, as well as other groups, responded again by doing a series of excellent epidemiological studies, which, like the MMR studies, showed that there was no increased risk in those who'd received thimerosal-containing vaccines as compared to those who received thimerosal-free vaccines. So I would argue that public health officials have listened to parents. I mean, the problem isn't that they haven't listened. The problem is that they haven't found one shred of evidence to support some parents' fears. I mean, the study that was recently published in the New England Journal of Medicine in September of 2007 by Bill Thompson and colleagues from the CDC was a beautiful study. It involved more than 1,000 children who were examined with more than 40 psychiatric and neurodevelopmental tests to answer the question, did thimerosal cause even subtle neurological or developmental problems? And the answer was clearly no. That was a $5.2 million study, and it was one of now 16 studies that have looked. There has now been a lot of money devoted to the question of whether vaccines cause autism, and the answer has been consistently no. I mean, were I the parent of an autistic child at this point, I would feel like this is money that's been wasted on a dead-end hypothesis, and angry, frankly, that those who oppose vaccines, or at least the group of parents who believe, frankly, as one holds a religious belief, which is to say, meaning strongly, even in the absence of contrary evidence, is something that now has shown itself to be a dead-end hypothesis. And I think at this point it's money wasted. You know, the fact is public health officials have listened. So another quote is, I told my pediatrician, and the reaction I got was making me feel dumb and stupid, and I felt very alone in this. So what Jenny McCarthy did with this is she set herself up against her physician. She was treated badly by her physician. She was a mother who cared, and she was isolated and alone and made to feel dumb. Now, this plays very well in the media and is very hard to go up against. I mean, I think that when Chris says that it's too bad that a CDC official wasn't on the show, I don't think a CDC official, frankly, should have been on the show, because I think he or she couldn't have possibly looked good against the parent of an autistic child who feels that vaccines cause it, and further, frankly, offered hope for a cure, as she said in other parts of the program. But this sort of dates back to the late 1800s. There was a guy who wrote for the Chicago Post named Finley Peter Dunn. And he came up with kind of what has become a journalistic mantra of that one should comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. And so we love the David and Goliath story. I mean, any person that would have appeared on that show, and I was actually asked by the producers about being on that show before it appeared, I think it would have been crazy to go on that show, because you offer nothing. I mean, all you're going to say is that Jenny McCarthy, who is a sympathetic parent, is wrong. You're going to try and argue a personal, emotional story with statistics, and it's a very hard thing to do. So there are certain situations which are away games, but you don't want to make it such, you don't want to play a game that have rules that you make it so that you cannot possibly win. I mean, that's true. So, and this is our culture. I mean, you see, this is a picture of the movie starring Julia Roberts called Erin Brockovich. You know, she brought a small town to its feet and a huge company to its knees. And this is you know, the sort of big guy, little guy. You couldn't help but appear as Goliath in a story like that. And similarly, A Civil Action was the story about a lawyer seeking justice for a tannery in Woburn, Massachusetts, that dumped a chemical into the aquifer. So it's really a sort of a part of our culture, hard to get around. And so I think that the way that this plays out is in the media is that if you really do care about children with autism, then you support the notion that vaccines are the cause. Lawyers, politicians, fringe scientists, and journalists care. And I mean, there's probably no better example recently than John McCain. You know, John McCain, during one of his stump speeches in Texas, said there is now abundant scientific evidence that mercury-containing preservative in vaccines, thimerosal, causes autism. Well, I mean, I think that McCain is a decent man. I think that what he felt he was doing was that he felt he was helping these parents of children who have autism. And I mean, I would argue I would argue, first of all, that he's doing exactly the opposite of that. I mean, he's hurting children that have autism. And you know, doctors, public health officials, mainstream scientists, and pharmaceutical companies are always set up as not caring. But in fact, the doctors and scientists who oppose the notion that vaccines cause autism are standing up for the little guy. Because the notion that vaccines cause autism is out there, people as well-informed and well-educated as Chris Sheedy are still shaken by whether or not they really should give their children vaccines or should give children a number of vaccines at the same time. And in addition, because the notion such as thimerosal as a cause of autism is out there, people believe that they can give mercury-binding therapies that may make their child better, or worse, give things like Lupron, which could make their child better. So it's really given birth to a cottage industry of dangerous medicines and false hope. And I think, as I said before, I think it's really diverted limited resources away from far more promising leads and certainly arguably sources of support for these children. The other point is when she said at the end to loud and thunderous applause, "My science is named Evan and he's at home, that's my science." So what is science? This from Edmund Wilson's Consilience. Science is the systematic enterprise of gathering knowledge about the world and organizing and condensing that knowledge into testable laws and theories. With science, you formulate a hypothesis. In this case, you know, thimerosal causes autism, or the null hypothesis would be thimerosal doesn't cause autism. And then you establish burdens of proof, subject those proofs to statistical analysis, and ultimately, importantly, include rigorous controls in the kinds of studies that were done, epidemiological studies. Science stands on two foundations, which is that it should be subjected to peer review, published in good journals, and should be confirmed by other investigators, i.e. reproduced, and I think the second is the far more important. But what isn't science? Science certainly is not anecdote. I think that the notion or the phrase anecdotal evidence is a contradiction in terms. I think at best what Jenny McCarthy's experience is that her child was fine, got a vaccine, and then wasn't fine anymore. That raises the question, a question that is testable by the scientific method. So science isn't scientists, it's not scientific bodies, it's not the CDC or the American Academy of Pediatrics, nor is it specifically a body of knowledge. It's a way of answering a question. And the way that you answer that question is by doing what was done. And in many ways, we're all scientists. I mean, so for example, you know, your radio is broken and you're trying to figure out why, or it doesn't play. I mean, either the batteries aren't there, or it's not plugged in, or it's not tuned to an active station. You've just formulated a series of hypotheses, and you're going to subject each of those hypotheses processes to approve. That's science. I mean, it's just a way of thinking about something. So it's a little disconcerting when somebody says, I saw this happen to one person, and that's any sort of a proof. That's science, it's not science. And although scientists do get it wrong all the time, I think science is enormously self-correcting. You can argue that Andrew Wakefield's paper in a very prestigious medical journal, The Lancet, you know, raised the hypothesis. It certainly, since that hypothesis is tested, we found that's not the case. But I think to some, the fluidity of science can be disconcerting. The fact of the matter is that as science has advanced, as knowledge has advanced over the past couple centuries, you know, we throw away textbooks without a backward glance, you know, as we learn more and more. And I think it's fair for Jenny McCarthy and others to raise the hypothesis, but once tested, and I think, you know, in this case, tested quite extensively, we have to be able to move on. So this is my last slide. And so how would one do this? I mean, it's very easy to say what one shouldn't do, but I think that to counter Jenny McCarthy, obviously the CDC statement is you know, was not us at our best. I think we probably could have done better with that statement in itself, but just the fact that the CDC is represented as a faceless monolithic body meant you had no chance to win. I do think that there are many parents out there who do have children with autism who don't for a second believe that vaccines are a cause, many of whom also are pretty angry for the same things that I just talked about. And I think it would be interesting to have those parents on the show too, because I think they'll have far more of emotional impact. I mean, people like Peter Hotez, actually, who's the father of a severely autistic daughter, who is very, I think, eloquent about this and can speak to this. Although, this is an aside, and this is completely sexist, but I think you can't. It's hard to put a woman up against a man and ever have the man look good. I think it's better to have woman to woman, personally. But okay, it's good. And so the last point I think is that it is always a scientific argument. One should never abandon the science, but I think that you have to frame science in an emotional way by bringing it back to the child. And in this case, you know, that if you really do care about autistic children, you wouldn't follow this dead end lead to vaccines. That it's scaring people unnecessarily. That it's leading to these unnecessary treatments and doing a lot of harm. And I think I'd like to believe that if John McCain was educated, as compared to, I think, being misinformed about this, he would have done just that. So I will stop there and thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much. We have some time for questions. There's microphones in the aisle, and although I'm almost blind, I will do my best to see you. Is that Diane? Can we get the microphones on, please?
There we go. Thank you. Diane Peterson from the Immunization Action Coalition. No one has mentioned the polling case, the recent case that the federal courts decided. And I bring that up because we've had, once again, a number of states that are considering anti-thimerosal bills in their legislature that would prohibit use of vaccines containing thimerosal. And this is largely because of parents that believe the connection with their child's autism, and they're coming before committees with very, very emotional stories, just like Jenny's. How do you suggest we respond to a legislator who says, doesn't this recent federal court decision mean that there is some association, and shouldn't we go ahead and enact such a bill?
Right. So the strange case of Hannah Poehling, let's talk about that. And so I think it was around March 6th or so that the federal claims court, the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, decided to concede to this now 9-year-old child that her mitochondrial enzyme deficiency, which resulted in an encephalopathy that included features of autistic spectrum disorder, may have been worsened by receipt of several vaccines at one time. They conceded it without ever having an evidentiary hearing. So what does that teach us? Well, certainly children who have mitochondrial enzyme deficiencies, which are not common, because mitochondria are part of every cell, have every cell involved. And certainly, what do we know? We know that those children, when they are exposed to natural infections, like upper respiratory tract infections or intestinal infections, certainly have a worsening encephalopathy associated with that. The question is, do vaccines do that? There's absolutely no evidence that vaccines worsen children with mitochondria. mitochondrial encephalopathies? None. So, and because you can argue that these children, you know, are especially vulnerable to natural infection, they're exactly the ones who should be immunized. And if you want to, you know, we certainly have data in other situations. I mean, people with multiple sclerosis who can have neurological exacerbations associated with influenza A infection, when they're given influenza A vaccine, don't have exacerbations. Therefore, influenza vaccine protects against neurological exacerbations caused by influenza. You know, I think you need to understand the way the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program makes decisions, which is with great largesse. I mean, it's they believe, and arguably fairly, that if they're to keep people comfortable in a country that mandates vaccines, that they need an adequate pop-off valve, that this is that pop-off valve, that if anything, they're going to overcompensate rather than undercompensate, because if they undercompensate, their feeling is that things will spill over into civil court, state court, where things would be, then pharmaceutical companies would be directly sued, and we'd be right back to where we were in the mid-1980s when pharmaceutical companies were on the verge of abandoning vaccines for American children. They have settled claims that the hepatitis B vaccine caused multiple sclerosis, which is patently absurd. And they would agree is patently absurd. But they felt that this was something they should do. So I think, which is to say, the courts teach us nothing. I mean, the courts, these are scientific questions that need to be answered in a scientific venue. They've been answered largely in a scientific venue. The courts are simply a place to settle disputes. It's frustrating, actually, when, and I'm not blaming anybody, because I think it's easy to see how you can get into this, even the CDC and the American Academy of Pediatrics, when they responded to this, responded as if this was some sort of scientific or medical truth. You know, it's only a small percentage of children. It's not, they're not really saying vaccines. They're just a court that you know, is full of lawyers and judges that make these kinds of decisions that are free of things like, you know, medical fact. And one other point I'll make, and then I'll stop, is that when this court was originally put together, it was based on a preponderance of evidence, which is a civil standard. It's moved from a preponderance of evidence to all you have to have is a report, and in this case it was Andrew Zimmerman's report, that says that it's biologically plausible that one thing could be associated with another, even absent any biological or epidemiological data. I mean, hepatitis B vaccine causes multiple sclerosis? So that's where we are with the courts. And so what I would say is, and obviously it's not an easy way to say this, is that you need to educate people that these are scientific questions that have to be answered in scientific venues. The courts are something else.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for your talk, Paul. First, a comment. I think we're in a new era that's a post-rational era. Folks have not found that science answers all their questions, and I'm a scientist, so I agree with this. And so they're looking for other ways of testing ideas and getting to truth, whatever that is. But one thing that Ms. McCarthy said in her Oprah discussion, she referred to something about being concerned about one size fits all. And that's something I didn't hear you talk about. I'd be very curious to hear what you have to say about that comment. In Oregon, we did a case control study and we stratified communities by high, low, and medium exemption rates. And in the high exemption rate areas, we went and talked to a few of the providers that weren't vaccinating on ACIP schedules. And many of them told us that they're really trying to keep the parents in the fold. To accommodate parent concerns, whatever they could do to help parents keep vaccinating, at least for some vaccines.
Okay, well, 2 points. I think Chris mentioned this as well. It's perfectly understandable how someone could take a 2 or 4 month old, lie them on that crinkly white paper, and then panic when you see, you know, as many as 4 or 5 syringes lined up at the end of the table. It just appears to be too much. I would argue that it's not too much for a couple reasons. One is that although we only 100 years ago got one vaccine, the smallpox vaccine, you know, there have been advances since in the last couple hundred years. We've actually had advances. And those include advances in things like protein chemistry, protein purification, recombinant DNA technology, cell culture, so that we make much purer vaccines. And if you look at the number of immunologic components in that one smallpox vaccine, it was close to 200. If you take all 14 vaccines today, it's about 150. Two, it's, you know, vaccines, if you really want to scare yourself, Chris. I mean, all you have to do is just take a cotton swab and swab the child's nose and then look, you know, look at it under, you know, put it on a wet mount, look at it under the microscope. It's teeming with bacteria. I mean, you actually have, you have 10 times more bacteria on the surface of your body than you have cells in your body. And you actually make an immune response to those bacteria. I mean, you know, we make about 5 grams of secretory IgA a day. That's a tremendous metabolic commitment by the host to a single protein, because we want to keep those colonizing organisms colonizing. And people who have very poor immune systems aren't often able to do that. So I would argue that vaccines really are a trivial challenge. You know, you make 10 to the 9th new lymphocytes every day. You know, this is 150 essentially immunologic components in vaccines. So that's one. In terms of the one size fits all thing, I would just ask that people look at the notes section of you know, these vaccine schedules. I mean, you know, they're you know, pretty big and detailed. I think there's much in the way of precautions and contraindications that are considered for the individual children. So I think it's certainly a phrase that flies, but it's not based on what's real.
And if I can add to that, I think this concern is pretty getting more pervasive as the schedule grows, and I think that what Paul said addresses the rational scientific side. But I do think that we all need to sort of think on how we address the emotional component of this, because you know, you can tell me that, or you can tell any parent that, but like you said, it still is counterintuitive to sort of lay your baby out and have them, you know, go through the pain of those shots, and it also is a little bit scary. So, you know, I think as we move forward, we need to sort of struggle with addressing the emotional component of that, as well as how best to communicate the science of it.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, I think you certainly should never approach a parent by saying that you think that the fear makes no sense. I mean, there's a woman who worked in our laboratory who was a mom. Who was a virologist and immunologist, who when she brought her child, I mean, we've talked about these things, it's a gut reaction, it's perfectly understandable. I think you just have to do the best you can to try and say, look, here are the facts that should make you feel better. And I get this question all the time, and I would say, for the most part, it actually does make parents feel better, at least the ones that call me on the phone, but that's obviously a select group.
Okay. Hi, my name is Ginny
Haas,
and I'm from Connecticut. I'm an immunization coordinator in a local health district. And I'm the parent of an autistic bipolar child, and I promote immunizations. My son had his first rage at 17, at 13 months of age. And he had been, prior to that, a manic child. He had grins from ear to ear. We had him placed in our arms in an orphanage at 17 days of age, and he was happy continuously until that time. And I would be on the stage with Jenny McCarthy if I hadn't recognized the signs of his developmental problem, because the doctors just said, you know, who's going to complain about a happy baby? But my first job out of college was working with in a psychiatric hospital with bipolar and autistic children. And so I recognized mania when he was 6 months of age. There's a look. There's a thing, there's something that goes beyond normal baby happiness. When he got his shots, he'd go, and he turned for more shots. He was different. But most people wouldn't recognize that. And of course, most people would not support me if I went around saying I have a manic baby, because they think you're crazy. But he had gone flip side to the depression end at 13 months of age. And I think we have to address, instead of going back and saying it's not the shots, we have to say, what is it? And we have to go to the mental health people and lobby and say, we need causes for these things, to more research in that direction, because these kids hurt. This is horrible. And these people are going out there with their own rage at nobody listening to them. And who's not listening to them are the people who blame parents for their children's illness. We've seen autistic development used to be blamed on refrigerator mothers. That's what they were called, refrigerator mothers, because they caused the autism in their children. And now we don't do that, but the blame's still there. and these parents are still feeling it everywhere. What did you do to make this kid like this? And people won't say that, and how they try to get beyond it, but they don't. So I think we have to go beyond that, and we have to go beyond our own immunization framework, and we have to really empathize with them and say, you've got a real issue here, you've got a real cause, and we really, really want to find the cause of what that was all about.
Thank you. You know, one thing you said actually reminded me of something is that, you know, you being closer to this child saw things that were developmentally questionable earlier on. Is when my wife watched this Jenny McCarthy segment, her reaction was that when Jenny said, you know, that's not the autism shot, is it? Oh, my God, you know, I hope you're right. She said that she thought that already Jenny was concerned about her child, that's really what prompted that. And it's that may be true. It's interesting. I mean, about 20% of autism arguably is regressive between the first and second year, but most isn't. So
we need to work with that.
Yeah.
And if I can comment, too, well, first of all, thank you for sharing that. And just to clarify that, you know, when I said I was disappointed that an expert wasn't on Oprah, I didn't necessarily mean a CDC immunization expert. In fact, you know, my disappointment was that there wasn't an autism expert on Oprah. And that, you know, I think we do need to sort of pull this conversation to a bigger place and have the autism experts talking about autism. But again, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, you know, it's to underline that point, that's a perfect point, is that, I don't know if you saw Larry King Live when he had Jenny McCarthy on the show, but he had Jenny McCarthy, then he also had a woman, remember, who has the autistic child who's the basketball guy, the guy that shot the three-pointers, and there were three mothers, actually, and he sort of went around and he said, you know, what do you think causes autism? What do you think causes autism? I'm thinking, you know, why don't you ask an autism expert what they think causes autism? You know, that would inform your public a little better.
Okay, thank you. Back microphone.
Thing is working. Yeah. Good morning. I wear several hats as well. I'm a health educator who promotes immunization. I'm an Oprah watcher. I'm a CDC supporter. I support all of your research, and I'm also a mother. I'm very happy to say that I am a mother of three children, and they all have been immunized, and they're in their teens now, and they live successful lives. But the question that I want to ask is, what approach will the CDC take to address the issue, science versus mother's instinct? Because it is a very sensitive issue. And how, I mean, we need to know more than just science, but how will you address the emotional end? And I've worked with many mothers of children with autism, and I have to watch the mothers take the lead in having some of their children to go through something called chelation therapy, mm-hmm. to try to remove mercury out of their children's blood and hope to see some progress in their children's growth and development. But what approach would a CDC take to address that issue, other than just the science, which is going to be there, but how would you communicate that back to the average parent?
Thank you for that question.
Well, it's I'll start and then turn over to Chris. It's certainly chelation, which is a chemical that, or a series of chemicals that can bind to any divalent cation, including mercury, that can, in theory, help rid it from the body. Is dangerous medicine. I mean, there was a death in suburban Pittsburgh associated with chelation therapy, and chelation therapy, I mean, once a cell is actually damaged by a heavy metal, it doesn't get better with chelation. I mean, you're really trying to chelate the mercury that's there that hasn't damaged cells. So when people tell you, like Jenny McCarthy, that, you know, I rub chelation therapy on my son's body, and like the next day he was speaking, that's just not possible. So it's not based on anything that makes sense. It can only, because it can't possibly help, it can only harm. I do think, I always am concerned about, questions about it can't, it can't just be science. I certainly agree that in order to have an emotional impact, and I'll turn this over to Chris to answer this, you need to frame science in a way that's understandable and emotional. I think that's true, but you can never get away from science. I mean, the science is all we have that separates us, that separates sort of ignorance from enlightenment. It's the only way we ever have of answering these questions, and frankly, it's the best thing you have that can reason with people. And so, but I'll turn it over to Chris for that.
we get into trouble if we dismiss, you know, mother's intuition and their gut feelings that they just know. So, I mean, first and foremost, I think we have to acknowledge that. And again, like for those of you who were in Barbara Reynolds' session just prior to this, expressing empathy first off is really important. And I guess what I'm about to say might be controversial, and I might get tomatoes thrown at me, but I think, you know, we also need to think seriously about what they're saying. And like Paul showed us in his presentation, we've done a whole lot of research to look at these questions that they're raising, but I think we have to continually ask ourselves, what else might we need to be doing? You know, what does the research tell us? Are there holes or gaps? And I think we need to continue to be open-minded.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that. I think science is enormously open-minded. It is. I mean, if you have a hypothesis about whether one thing causes something else, you can test it. If you have a hypothesis about whether one thing treats something else, you can test it. But I guess and this may be where I'm disagreeing slightly with Chris, I think you should be open-minded to a point. I think you do get to that point where science really has largely, and I think that's been true here, exonerated vaccines. And I do think that by keeping this story alive, although I certainly understand parents are concerned and those concerns should be addressed, I feel badly, actually, when more money is spent looking at this. I just think it's money wasted, frankly, at this point. And I don't think it's going to matter. I think, you know, we've got 16 studies, we have 20 studies, 30 studies, 50 studies. I don't think there's a magic number out there. I think we've done it. So I think we just have to try and figure out ways to be convincing, and as Chris said, in a difficult setting. I mean, mommy instinct, as Jenny said, I mean, I think that's good to a point. I mean, my mother wasn't right all the time. Maybe I had the wrong mother. But everybody else's mother right all the time? But, I mean, I think mommy instinct, you know, it's not a bad start. But, you know, moms aren't always right. And Jenny wasn't right here.
And I agree with that. And you know, I'm not sure I'm saying more CDC studies are in order. And, I mean, just to disclose, I started at CDC in the Office of Genomics. So I'm personally sort of interested in individual variability, and so and you know, beyond the what CDC is.
We have a number of people at the microphones, and our time is getting short. I'm not sure we will get to everyone, but we'll take as many questions as we can. Can I have the first person at the back microphone over here, please?
Thank you. One question Paul raised a moment ago on the Larry King show, where he had three moms with autistic children. He said, "Where was the autism expert?" He thought he had them there, as Jenny McCarthy said, "My science is at home, Evan." And that leads to the comment I wanted to make that what we're doing isn't working. I mean, it's working fine. We've got low numbers of vaccine-preventable diseases, but we're also passionate about immunization, that we want it to be perfect, and we don't want any people refusing vaccines, and that's why we're here talking about this. Looking at the past is fascinating, the causes of all of this, I think, probably the biggest one, at least as it relates to this topic, is the change that began in the late 1960s, taking authority away from authority figures and making it autonomy. I know everything. I can choose what's well for my life. And although, Christine, you did mention that when you were pregnant, you listened to the doctors and read the books and did everything they told. So I'm going to suggest that we do something new and different, because we all in here, I don't think that what we're doing is working very well. To try to get out the Hannah Poling story, which is so detailed and so scientific, mitochondrial disorder, that's impossible. I went to my doctor a few years ago, and when he finished his exam, he said, "You have mild high blood pressure, and I want to put you on some medication." And we all know that's a silent disease, and I felt fine, and I said, "Well, I don't really like putting chemicals in my body if I don't have to, so tell me why I should do this." And he said, "Because otherwise you have a good chance of, or you have a chance of getting a stroke or dying." So I said, "Let me have a prescription." Why isn't that working in this field? Since what isn't working, I have my theory, and that is that pediatricians and others who take care of children, although we don't do very well on adult vaccines either, aren't accorded the same respect as those who care for adults and do surgery and all the glamorous stuff. We need to look at some other ways that this has been addressed and stop beating down the same horse. A lot of what comes out is more harmful than helpful. I hate in this venue to say it, but I've been dying to, so I will. The CDC's 1 in 150 American children have autism has been a horrible statistic to put out there for those of us that are trying to disassociate vaccines as a causative agent in autism, because that's a headline in USA Today or a soundbite and doesn't get the support of information about, well, the diagnosis has been broadened in its interpretation. So I'd like to hear us, leaders, think about looking at some other parts of medical care. That's a good place to start. And what works, and how can we apply that to what we're doing?
Yeah, I'm going to not, thank you, that's very helpful. I'm going to take a somewhat different stance. I don't think it's that people, that parents are less likely to listen to their pediatrician than they are to the doctor that takes care of them. I think people die of strokes and heart attacks all the time. I mean, it's very easy to point to that. You know somebody that may have recently died of a stroke or heart attack. It happens all the time. You know, it's hard to say, you know, if you don't get this measles vaccine or rubella vaccine or polio vaccine, you know, you're going to die of polio. I mean, people don't see these diseases. They're largely eliminated from this country. So you're making really an historical argument, which is you know, not a strong one. I think that, you know, that however, you know, should one not get these vaccines, I think this is a natural consequence, frankly, of largely eliminating these diseases. People don't see them. They're not as compelled by them. They're not scared of them. And I think that what you're seeing is somewhat of a slippage, or at least an increase in the percentage of people who aren't getting immunized or those who are choosing not to get immunized, I think would have been expected to happen. And so what I suspect will happen, and Bob Chen actually had a wonderful slide of this showing kind of the natural history of the immunization program, is that you'll start to see some slippage. I think that'll happen. And Dan Salmon had a paper in JAMA that said just this, that you'll start to see more people opting out of vaccines, that in those areas where people are opting out of vaccines, you'll start to see greater numbers of children that have, for example, pertussis. I mean, we did have a measles epidemic in 2005. We had a mumps epidemic that sort of swept across the Midwest. You're starting to see at least some, mumps is maybe not a perfect example, but I think, you know, you're starting to see some evidence. I think you'll continue to see evidence of the diseases. And then what'll happen is we'll probably get to a tipping point again where people realize, my God, I mean, there's just been a polio epidemic in Minnesota or something in an Amish community, and that's enough to tip it back over again. That's Bob Chen's slide. So I'm going to argue that he may have been right in all this. I don't think that the goal should be reasonably a goal, that 100% of children are immunized and everybody buys into it. I think this is a natural consequence of a very successful program.